Good afternoon, everybody. It looks like I'm the first experimentalist in this session. I will talk about dynamic arrest in multi-component glass forming systems. This is joint work with Andreas Meyer from the DLR in Cologne. The group of Andreas Meyer prepared the multi-component metallic glasses and also did quasi-elastic neutron scattering, while our group was involved in the diffusion measurements. I would like to acknowledge contributions from Professor Klaus Retzke and Alexander Bartsch. Alexander Bartsch was a PhD student who carried out the work, and our work was constantly supported by the German Science Foundation. Yeah, this is a picture of Kiel, where I come from. It's located at the Baltic Sea in the north of Germany. Our university has about 23,000 students, and I'm in the material science department. Yeah, my talk is outlined as follows. I will briefly discuss strategies for glass forming ability, which is probably known to most of you, but this is important in the connection of interpreting our data. It turns out that depending on the way the glass forms, the arrest looks different. Then as a reference system, I will talk about the diffusion in simple liquids. And then I will come to dynamic arrest and the glass transition. And in the main part of my talk, I will present our radiotracer diffusion studies, which we carried out. We studied multi-component systems with four and more components. And for the first time, we were able to study the diffusivities of all components. Particularly important are the large components, for instance, in the palladium glasses or in the zirconium glasses. We were also able to study zirconium diffusion, which was not possible so far. And it will turn out that the mobility of these large components is very important in connection with structural arrest. In the zirconium alloys, we even see anomalies in the diffusion behavior in the ordinary liquid state, far above TC. Yeah, and then I will draw some conclusions. Yeah, I think this is known to most of you, strategies for glass forming ability. The obvious way to form glasses is to have strong covalent bonds. This is true for the oxide glasses, for amorphous semiconductors, for instance. And in those cases, as everybody knows, it's very easy to form glasses. Those systems have excellent glass forming ability. The other strategy is to go to particles which are quite complex and asymmetric. As everybody knows, a hard sphere system of equally sized spheres will not crystallize, will easily crystallize and will not form a glass. So here the structural complexity of the building units is important to form a glass. And I will show you that those systems behave quite different from metallic systems. For metallic glasses, the main idea is dynamic symmetry. So you need size disparity. If you want to have good glass forming abilities, you mix atoms of quite different sizes. Of course, not only size disparity is involved, you also have short range order, which in metallic systems is also very important. Yeah. And particularly those two systems show quite different behavior when it comes to structural arrest. Yeah, I start with a very simple reference system, which you all know. In simple liquids, we have essentially gas-like diffusion behavior. We have uncorrelated binary collisions, and the diffusivity is well described by the average mean free path and the average thermal velocity. And the average thermal velocity is proportional to 1 over the mass of the individual particles. This is theoretically as well as experimentally well established. Isotope effect measurements in simple metallic one-component melts show that this 1 over square root m mass dependence is well obeyed. And as everybody knows, in those simple liquids, the Stokes-Einstein equation holds, which relates diffusivity and viscosity. Yeah, if we now cool down the system and go to the supercooled liquid state, we have a gradual transition from uncorrelated binary collisions to more and more correlation, which comes into play. And finally, this has been mentioned many times already today, one sees the cage effect. A given atom is surrounded by its nearest neighbor cage. And this finally leads to a freezing in of a liquid-like motion. the Vogel-Fulcher law is found to hold, and one finds a very steep increase in viscosity on a logarithmic scale versus 1 over t. And it's also well known that in this regime, the Stokes-Einstein equation breaks down. And recently, it has proposed by Erdinger and others that this breakdown of the Stokes-Einstein equation is directly related to dynamic heterogeneity. Yeah. As mentioned already, the probably best suited theory so far, despite its shortcomings, to describe the structural arrest is the mode coupling theory. And according to the mode coupling theory, this cage effect finally leads to a freezing in of liquid-like motion. And I have to emphasize this, also it's well known, this critical temperature TC in experimental systems where liquid-like motion stops is much larger, particularly in these metallic systems, than the caloric glass transition temperature. I emphasize this because in computer simulations, you cool down the system usually quite quickly, and the difference between TC and TG is generally quite small. But experimentally, it's pretty large, much more than 100 Kelvin. Yeah, and below the critical temperature of mode coupling, it has been mentioned already, theoretically it's very difficult to say anything, but Sjögren, and this has also been cited today, Sjögren already proposed that below TC one has highly collective, what he called medium-assisted hopping processes, and our chairman was a little bit careful with this and said this may be rather exotic. I will convince you today that this is not the case, that these highly collective hopping processes are typical in glassy systems, although this is only a side aspect of my talk today. Yeah, the techniques we are using to study theoretical predictions are quite simple. We are using the well-known radiotracer methods. In radiotracer methods, you can radioactively tag atoms, and you can study the dynamics of all the different components of a complicated system individually, at least in principle. Experimentally, it's quite complicated, particularly to study the slow diffusivities of these large components. And the main idea is, as shown here, you deposit a very thin layer of a radio tracer on top of your sample. In the ideal case, you aim for a delta function, and then upon annealing, the tracer diffuses into the sample, and in order to get a diffusion profile, what you do is you carry out a serial sectioning of your sample. So at low temperatures where the diffusivities are small and the penetration depth is in the range of a nanometer, we used ion beam sputtering. This is a technique, I don't want to go into details, which allows you to follow the penetration profiles with almost a resolution of a few nanometer. At more elevated temperatures, you can simply do mechanical grinding or other techniques to get the penetration profile. Then you count the activity in each of these sections, what you get as the solution, if you start with a Gaussian, if you start with a delta function, you get a Gaussian penetration profile. And by plotting the logarithm of the concentration versus the square of the penetration depth, you get a straight line. And knowing the diffusion time, you can directly extract diffusivity. Okay, here are some typical penetration profiles. This holds for palladium glass. This is often used in research, or has also some interesting applications. It has very high stability in the supercooled liquid state, so one has sufficient time to carry out diffusion experiments, which need, depending on temperature, several minutes, and so you need some stability. At lower temperatures, this is not an issue. There you can carry out diffusion experiments over even hours. Yeah, and what you can see here, if you plot the logarithm of the activity versus the square of the penetration depth, you get indeed straight lines, and from these slopes you can extract diffusivities. For those of you who are specialists on such experiments, the resolution function is always an issue. The resolution function is plotted here, and you can see the resolution function is much narrower than the penetration profile, so we can exclude artifacts from the resolution function. With such radio tracer techniques, you can also study diffusion of several isotopes simultaneously and can study the isotope effect. You can rearrange the thin film solution easily and can show that by plotting the logarithm of the concentration of one isotope over the concentration of the second isotope, alpha and beta, if you plot this versus the logarithm of the activity of one of both isotopes, you get a straight line according to this simple rearrangement of the thin film solution. And the slope of this straight line directly gives you the ratio of the two isotope diffusivities. And since in simple systems, if you have single jumps, or in liquids where you have only binary collisions, you expect one over square root mass dependence. I showed you this here. What you do, you define your isotope effect such that for a 1 over square root mass dependence, you get an isotope effect of unity. So one normalizes this expression with this factor, which takes into account the square root mass dependence. So an isotope effect of unity would mean if you are in a liquid, you have uncorrelated binary collisions. This has been shown before in simple liquid systems. Even in space, where you can exclude gravity effects. And if you are in the solid state, if you have single jumps, you would also get an isotope effect of unity. But what you can see here, these are measurements in the glassy state. This would correspond to an isotope effect of unity, and we see much smaller isotope effects, which is in fact quite close to zero. We have carried out isotope effects already some years ago in glassy systems. My talk today is more about the liquid state, but in this connection I also mentioned the glassy state because it was already also discussed before with the chairman. In these glassy systems, we always see extremely small isotope effects. So within experimental error bars, the isotope effect is very close to zero. This has been also seen in computer simulations. I particularly mentioned simulations of Dr. Schober, who is also in the audience. And these very low isotope effect results have been interpreted indeed in terms of this highly collective medium-assisted hopping process, which is predicted by Sjögren in his extension of the mode coupling theory. And the simple interpretation is if you have a single jump, then the diffusivity is inversely proportional to 1 over square root of the mass. You have the attempt frequency, and in the harmonic approximation, you have the simple 1 over square root mass dependence. If, however, a large number of atoms participates in the jump process, in the computer simulations, chain-like processes have been seen and some other highly collective processes, then the attempt frequency is not given by the individual mass. The attempt frequency is given by the effective mass of these of the large number of atoms. And then it depends on the system. Our experiments show that masses of at least 10, sometimes more atoms are involved in these processes. And Mr. Koop mentioned that these are more exotic processes which have occasionally seen in computer simulations. This is not at all the case. This is a typical way hopping processes take place in glassy systems. And I think also in the computer simulations, this is not seen as exotic processes. These are the typical processes which are responsible for long-range diffusion. Yeah, I'm really talking about these are not processes which take place in local minimums. In our experiments, at least, we measure long-range diffusion over large distances. So my clear statement here contradicting you is that those processes are really the typical processes in the glassy state, and this is also what Sjögren already predicted in his extension of the mode coupling theory to the glassy state, of course in a very qualitative way.
Yeah, I thought the question was whether you see it in experiments and how do you see it.
Yeah.
So how do you see it in experiments that you have these kind of
Yeah, okay. In the experiments, we cannot say whether it's a chain-like process, whether it's a ring process or so. In the experiment, we can only determine the mass of the atoms, only the effective mass. Yeah. The underlying microscopic picture, this comes from MD simulations. Yeah. Of course, this is deep in the glassy state. These are binary glasses, which have been studied in the deep in the glassy state. However, this also holds in supercooled liquids close to TC. And more recently, or it's not so recent actually, we carried out studies in zircon glasses, which show that also in the supercooled liquid state above the caloric rise transition temperature, you also see these hopping processes. Yeah, and today I would like to focus on higher temperatures near the Yes. Yes. It depends. If the number of atoms here is about 10, then we end up with 0.1 or so. It depends. It depends on the system. We also did systematic investigations in binary glasses over a large composition range where we could relate this also to structural changes. Professor Teichler published a computer simulation on binary nickel zirconium glasses, and we did some experiments, and it correlates quite nicely. But this is not the main subject of my talk.
Is it obvious that I should interpret the effective mass I get out of this analysis as being the size of the cluster?
Yes. The problem is this is related also to low frequency excitations in glasses, and one sees really these collective vibrations. So in a single jump process, you have an individual atom which jumps in the potential minimum and overcomes the barrier. I think this is also confirmed from computer simulations in these glassy systems. You have these collective vibrations, these low frequency excitations. A large number of atoms really is participating also in these vibrations.
Yeah, and I'm not challenging that idea. I'm just wondering whether, given that these ones are collective, you can make a simple identification and say you have an effective mass of 10 times atomic mass, so that means you have 10 atoms involved. Could it be that 100 atoms involved is some more involved?
Yeah. This is a weighted value. There's also Yes, I 100% agree with what you say. I 100% agree with what you say. This is why this is why we call it an effective mass. Yeah. I think the message I want to make here is it's far away from any single jump process. Yeah. It involves a large number of atoms in a complicated way, and from our measurements we cannot give a microscopic picture. Yeah. Okay, the next point I would like to discuss are again these palladium glasses, where we now have diffusion data and also data from quasi-elastic neutron scattering over 14 orders of magnitude, starting in the ordinary liquid well above the melting point and far above TC, down to the glassy state. And in particular, in this system, from quasi-elastic neutron scattering, the critical temperature of mode coupling theory has been determined. And here we can, in particular, study the dynamics around TC and see whether predictions of mode coupling theory are fulfilled. Let me start with the temperature range very near the caloric glass transition temperature. but above the caloric Larsen temperature. A few years ago, there were reports in the literature that the caloric Larsen temperature can be explained as a transition from a single jump diffusion mechanism to a collective mechanism above the caloric Larsen temperature. There were even two papers in Nature who put forward this idea. And this is why we studied the isotope effect under isothermal conditions, where we started with a state of the system which is in the glassy state, and then we relax the system isothermally, and this is only a small distance, but consider the scale, we are talking about a change in the diffusivity by more than an order of magnitude. And we at the same time, we did isotope effect measurements. The results are plotted here. And what you can see both in the glassy state as well as in the supercooled liquid state, where we have two data points here, the isotope effect is very low. We see no indications of single jump processes. In both cases, the dynamics are highly collective. We then studied the range between the caloric last transition temperature and TC. And according to mode coupling theory, liquid-like motion is frozen in here. And we indeed see a straight line here with a relatively high effective activation energy. And so in this regime, one has diffusion over constant barriers. And then according to mode coupling theory, at the critical temperature, liquid-like motion should set in. And this would mean the barriers start to decay gradually. And indeed, exactly at the temperature where independently by quasi-elastic neutron scattering, TC was determined, we see that this slope changes, and we see a gradual decrease in slope, which tells us that starting at TC, these barriers start to decay, and consequently, the slope goes down. Finally, in the regime above the critical temperature of mode coupling theory, we can compare our data with data from quasi-elastic neutron scattering, and we see very good agreement. This tells us that convection phenomena, which are sometimes involved in macroscopic diffusion measurements in liquids, can be safely excluded because neutron scattering is on a scale where convection doesn't play any role, and we see very good agreement. So experimentally, the data are well proved. And in this temperature regime, in the ordinary liquid, we also carried out isotope effect measurements, and we see again very low values of the isotope effect. And this has to be compared with measurements in ordinary liquids like liquid tin or others. In those systems where you have essentially uncorrelated binary collisions, the isotope effect is quite large, of the order of unity, while here, even in the ordinary liquid, our isotope effects are very small. And this indicates that even in the ordinary liquid in those systems, we have very strong correlations, highly collective processes, far away from a hydrodynamic regime of binary uncorrelated collisions. I now would like to come to our recent results on diffusivities in, again, the same multi-component system. Now, for the first time, we were able to study diffusion of all components, and in particular, we also included palladium, which plays a major role in glass forming ability of these systems. And we got quite interesting results concerning the differences in the diffusivities of these systems. Again, I show results starting in the ordinary liquid at high temperatures down to the caloric glass transition temperature. And what one can see, as expected, the diffusivities in the ordinary liquid don't show much disparity. And even if we go below TM in the supercooled regime, until very close to TC, these diffusivities are essentially identical, as one would expect also from the Stokes-Einstein equation. If one comes close to TC, already a little bit above TC, one sees a very strong decoupling here. However, this decoupling is twofold. For the small components, one sees only very little decoupling, while very large decoupling is observed between the large component palladium, these are the red data points, and the smaller components. And this decoupling is very pronounced. Near the caloric Larsen transition temperature, we are talking about four orders of magnitude decoupling. I have to point out that this decoupling of the diffusivities has to be distinguished from viscous decoupling between diffusion and viscosity, because as you know, we have a broad distribution of mobilities, and if you compare viscosity and diffusivity as a transferred quantity, it could well be that viscosity and diffusivity simply probe the distribution of mobilities in a different way. And so the violation of the Stokes-Einstein equation could simply be a consequence of the different ways these distributions of mobility are probed. However, here we directly study diffusivities, and we see that we have a strong disparity of the diffusivities starting around TC in those systems. If one now compares diffusion with viscous flow, Hausleitner and Liu published data on viscosity. One can also make statements on the validity of the Stokes-Einstein equation. What we did here in this plot is we took the Stokes-Einstein equation and converted our diffusivities into viscosities and compared these viscosities with the viscosities reported in the literature. These are the black data points here. And what you can see, as also reflected in the diffusion plot I just showed, as long as we are in the ordinary melt, the diffusivities and the viscosities and the diffusivities converted into viscosities coincide quite well. This holds until close to TC. And below TC, we again see the strong deviations between diffusivity and viscosity. But as reflected in the diffusion plot I showed before, we only see these differences for the small components. To make the plot not too complicated, I only show a few small components here. For the small components, we see a very strong difference between diffusion and viscosity. For the majority component palladium, however, we see an excellent agreement of our diffusion data for palladium and the corresponding viscosity. Yeah, and this means, oh, this is doesn't play any role. We are talking about 14 orders of magnitude. The sizes you have, they differ by 10-15%. So this, yes. Yeah, I can't tell you the values, but well, 10% change on a scale of 40 orders of magnitude doesn't matter. Yeah. Huh? Sorry, I didn't get this point. Yes. Yeah. R here is the classical. I'm talking about the classical Stokes-Einstein equation. Yeah. Yeah. So what we see here, despite the strong decoupling of the diffusivities by four orders of magnitude near the caloric last transition temperature, the Stokes-Einstein equation holds very well for the large component palladium over 14 orders of magnitude. Yeah. 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 This is like, I'm coming to this. Yeah. This. Yeah. Okay. I'm pretty much through. Yeah, this is particularly remarkable because if you compare this with single component molecular glasses, there we see a different behavior. There are many reports on comparison between Stokes between viscosity and diffusion. I have chosen the most recent one, but there are earlier results, and all these results show that there is indeed a difference between diffusivities converted to viscosities and viscosity measurements. So here the Stokes-Einstein equation is violated, maybe as expected, and this is always taken as evidence for dynamic heterogeneity. So in our system, it's clearly obvious that the Stokes-Einstein equation for the large component holds over 14 orders of magnitude, and these measurements were completely independent. In one case, we are talking about viscosity measurements, and in our case, we did radio tracer diffusion studies. So this cannot be by chance. I think it's from the experimental point of view, it's pretty clear. Yeah, your question, how can we interpret this? And I think there is a quite obvious interpretation, at least from our point of view, it's obvious that palladium forms a slow subsystem upon cooling down. And in this slow subsystem, the smaller atoms can diffuse, while palladium already is more or less arrested. At least the time scale of diffusion of palladium is much longer than the time scale of diffusion of these other components, while relaxation of the system and viscous flow is determined by the movement of this more rigid palladium network. So I think this is quite remarkable because we are not talking about covalent systems here. We are talking about metallic systems which have non-directed and non-covalent bonds. And nevertheless, the interplay of size effects and chemical charge range order seems to promotes formation of such a rigid network here. There are computer simulations, hard sphere simulations by Kuma et al., and there are some other computer simulations in the literature which show that such a immobile network can also form without short-range order. Size disparity alone is already sufficient to promote the formation of such a network. However, if you want to get such a network only with size disparity, you need huge differences in sizes of the atoms, which are not realistic in real systems. So in metallic systems, this only works because in addition to size disparity, we have very pronounced chemical short range order. At least this is our way to interpret these results. recently, we have also studied the zirconium-based systems. We studied Vitreloy 1 and Vitreloy 4. And here we can also compare data of quasi-elastic neutron scattering with data, in this case, particularly of zirconium diffusion. At low temperatures in the glassy states, there are many results from our own group and from the literature. This is something I'm not going to discuss today. What I want to show today are, as I think, quite remarkable results in the ordinary liquid state. So we are talking about a temperature range where we are already far above TC. TC in this system, again, was determined by neutron scattering. And here we are far above the critical temperature of mode coupling theory. And at these high temperatures, you would expect Stokes-Einstein to be well obeyed. However, what you see here, these are data in Vitreloy 1 and Vitreloy 4 on diffusion of copper and nickel. And here are our radio tracer data on diffusion of zirconium. And you see a clear difference by about an order of magnitude, even a little bit more, even in the ordinary liquid state. So it looks like this decoupling of diffusivities in those zirconium-based systems even sets in at very high temperatures in the ordinary liquid state. And I think this is quite remarkable because usually in normal liquids, in the equilibrium state, you consider the Stokes-Einstein equation as being always obeyed. We also have literature data on viscosity in this system. However, here I have to be a little bit careful. These are data for the viscosity in Vitreloy 1, while the diffusion studies were carried out in Vitreloy 4. On the other hand, the neutron data are in very good agreement in both systems, Vitreloy 1 and Vitreloy 4. So we believe that the viscosity data for Vitreloy 1 are also a good estimate of the viscous behavior. And if one makes this assumption, one sees that again, the viscosity data and the diffusion data coincide very well. So the Stokes-Einstein equation again seems to be obeyed for the larger component. However, one has to be a little bit careful here. I point this out because tomorrow Ralf Busch will give a talk on viscosity measurements in Vitreloy 1, where he sees strong non-Newtonian behavior and history dependence of viscosity. So concerning the viscosity data, I cannot say too much in this system. But what is very clear here is this strong decoupling of the diffusivity of zirconium and of the smaller components by more than an order of magnitude, even in the ordinary liquid state. Let me briefly summarize. We studied diffusivities in multi-component systems near and above the critical temperature of mode coupling theory. And for the small components, we see very little component decoupling, while we see a huge decoupling between the diffusivity of the large component and of the smaller components. On the other hand, for the large component, the Stokes-Einstein equation seems to be very well obeyed over, well, in this case, 14 orders of magnitude. And this is interpreted by us as the formation of a slow subsystem, which the large and majority component forms. And within this subsystem, the small components diffuse. And structural relaxation, as well as viscosity, as well as viscous flow in such systems, seems to be dominated by the rearrangement of this slow subsystem. Yeah. And apparently, size effects and short range order in these metallic systems give rise to the formation of such a subsystem, while computer simulations show that if the size disparity is very large, then you can even get such subsystems without chemical short range order, only from size disparity. Yeah. We also did some earlier studies in the glassy state, but I have no time to go into detail, but we recently published a review on that. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Franz, for this presentation. Questions, comments? You already talked.
There's something I'm very confused about with regards to the isotope effect in the viscous liquid.
Yes.
So there's been many computer simulations, or at least a fair number of them, including by our chairman, mm-hmm. that compared Newtonian dynamics for a thermal liquid to Brownian dynamics. Mm-hmm. Brownian means effectively there's a friction and inertia is not important. Mm-hmm. So with regards to viscous relaxation, there's not much difference, especially at long times. Mm-hmm. So my conclusion from that is that inertial effects aren't important. And if inertial effects aren't important, why are we talking about mass? And so is the lack of an isotope effect in the viscous liquid regime simply a reflection of the fact that what we mean by viscous relaxation is largely, if not entirely, overdamped?
I showed the simple picture of uncorrelated binary collisions, where obviously the mass plays a key role, and you see the square root mass dependence. And this is also experimentally confirmed. If you do these isotope effect measurements in simple liquids, you see that there is a mass dependence. Yes. If you go to the supercooled liquid regime, you see these very strong correlations coming into play. So you have not uncorrelated binary collisions, but a large number of atoms comes into play. And the isotope effect in this case is also influenced by the correlation factor, which also leads all effects which influence the diffusivity except the diffusion of the tagged atom enter into the isotope effect. So if you have highly correlated jump processes, then this will also lead to a lower isotope effect.
Now, of course, there's a correlated dynamic, but I think you're not addressing the question. My statement is simulations
with inertia and simulation which has mass in it, right? Newton's laws. Mm-hmm. And simulations with no inertia or Brownian dynamics lead to very similar long time relaxation and diffusion in supercooled liquids. Yeah. So how can one rationalize that but with the mass effect?
Yeah. But doesn't this simply say, in other words, that the mass is not important?
Yes.
Right. Well, this is exactly my point, judging from our experiments.
But deducing from this something about the detailed nature of the correlated dynamics is a little more difficult with regards to atoms hopping and what the effect of mass is.
Yes, I agree. This is why I said we can only tell something about the way the mass contributes, and our clear statement, judging from the experiments, is that the mass doesn't play a role, in conclusion with what you said. We don't, from our these chain-like displacement processes, this comes from computer simulations from Schober and others. This is not the conclusion from our work. To most of you, this may not be too surprising nowadays, but if we think back to the time where we published these papers, and Dr. Schubert knows what I'm talking of, there were always these ideas that in glasses you have single jump processes similar to crystalline systems. People were talking about quasi-vacancy mechanisms, and probably here in this audience I don't have to confuse, I don't have to convince people that these dynamics are collective. On the other hand, you this morning also stated these are single jump processes. So my point is, I want to emphasize that these are highly collective processes. So that's the point I want to make here in connection with isotope effect. All the things the main part of my talk was not dealing with isotope effect at all, by the way.
So just before I ask my question, I think what you've seen in computer simulations is probably for one component, that the long time dynamics is not affected. But but if you had sort of, I don't know how much, from what I vaguely recall, when there are big mass differences, it does show up in the dynamics.
Yeah. Oh, there's one point I'm not saying anything about your simulations, but I don't know the details, but there are simulations in the literature, if the system size is too small, and the time you simulate is too short, then you don't see these processes. This is something I really have to emphasize. Professor Teichler did detailed studies on this. If in a small system you cannot see such highly collective process, there you need really long computer time, large number of atoms. So if in a computer simulation you don't see the processes, this doesn't mean in reality they don't exist. Yeah. Yeah, maybe, but I'm not referring to your work.
Let me go to my question. You showed two components out of four, which seem to have this non-violation of the Stokes-Einstein.
No, so only the large component has a non-violation of the Stokes.
There were two graphs, two curves.
No. This one graph was a diffusion plot. The other was a viscosity plot.
You had four sets of data, but this one.
So only palladium obeys the Stokes-Einstein equation.
What about the triangles and the green circles?
These are different. We studied a large number of. These are all the other small components.
So I should only look at those two data sets.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right.
So you talk about decoupling of the diffusion from the different constituents, and you showed two different systems, zirconium base and palladium base.
Yes.
And you made a big deal that the strongest decoupling was for the largest component, and that was very clear in your results. Mm. And in fact, when you looked at the zirconium base system, the slowest diffusing species was the largest, and the fastest diffusing species was the smallest, and they seemed to scale in between. That was very nice. In the palladium system, however, they followed a different pattern. The largest atom was still the slowest, but phosphorus, which is typically the smallest atom, wasn't the fastest diffusing atom. The transition metals were. Am I reading too much into the small differences in your data, or if there is a difference, do you have any explanation for why that was so?
If you call four orders of magnitudes...
No. I'm just looking at the difference between the phosphorus and the transition metals. I'm sorry, the chromium.
This one.
No, the one with palladium.
You say stop.
Yeah, okay, yeah, so this is it, palladium phosphorus. So the phosphorus is the open, the green circles.
Yeah.
And it's not the fastest diffusing species, although typically it's the smallest atom.
Yes, of course, not only size is here important, also chemical interaction, short range order. In fact, about phosphorus, there was quite a discussion. Some years ago, it was claimed that phosphorus in these systems is the most important one, that it plays the role of a network former, and there were several papers related to this, but it's clear from our data that phosphorus is quite fast in the system and doesn't play a key role in glass forming ability.
But it's not as fast as
yes, sure. There are other factors than size determining the mobility, but size seems to be a very important factor.
Right, but I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that the relative magnitudes here is different than what you see in the zirconium-based system.
Yes.
In that case, the beryllium is the smallest atom, and it does move the fastest. Yeah. So would you argue then maybe that there's that these other factors that also come into play are different for the two systems?
Yes. I think in terms of short range order, there are differences between these systems.
And do you have any thoughts about what might influence that short range order? Chemical interactions or?
Yes, I think it's chemical interactions, electronic interactions between the systems. Professor Teichler did some time ago on, not on these complicated systems, but on other systems, some work on chemical short range order based on molecular dynamics simulations. Depending on the concentration, you are in quite different packaging regimes. But it's, again, packaging sounds a little bit like size effects, but it's more than size effects. The chemical interactions play a major role here.
Now, and just one last part of that then, is there any specific understanding of how those chemical interactions are manifest or how we define them?
Well, if you have a given atom, the probability to find an atom of the same kind in these systems is much lower than to find an atom of a different kind. And on the other hand, if the majority component is in a high concentration, then neighborhoods of the same kind cannot be avoided. I think Professor Egami will also address this question in his talk a little bit, right? Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
This early Nature paper you mentioned, they talked about at low temperatures the mechanism changes to single atom hopping again. So, and you don't see this, right?
Right.
So what's your explanation? What's the reason for this discrepancy?
Yes. Well, if in terms of mode coupling theory or other theoretical approaches, you wouldn't expect any difference at the caloric glass transition temperature. At the caloric glass transition, the system simply runs out of thermodynamic equilibrium. That's all. It's a kinetic transition. Of course, there may be a thermodynamic transition at a somewhat lower temperature, that's a different story, but the experimentally observed caloric glass transition is simply a transition where the system runs out of equilibrium.
I think their NMR data were not trustworthy.
Pardon?
The measurement they did using NMR and so on, you think they were not reliable? Is that your conclusion?
There are several papers in the literature claiming that there is a real phase transition. Personally, I'm not convinced by any of these. I think it's a kinetic transition, and I have also evidence for this. There's a group of Professor Mera in Münster, for instance, and Macht in Berlin. They studied this phenomenon in more detail, and they could clearly relate it to purely kinetic phenomena. Of course, there's this question about the Kauzmann temperature, but this is happening at lower temperature.
So the diffusivity data that you showed seemed to go from being fragile to at least stronger as at low temperatures. And there's some reports that this may be generic for metallic glasses. Is this something you wish to comment on?
Yeah, the fragility plays a role here. These are relatively strong systems. The zirconium system is slightly stronger than the palladium system, but this term strong and fragile may be overestimated sometimes a little bit. This was already discussed in the morning.
Can I ask you to the isotope effect again? Can you show the picture, please, where it goes through the TG and TC and all that? No, different picture.
Yes, sorry. I know.
Here we go.
Yeah.
And you're saying here for this palladium system now, which you interpret later as the subsystem, the slow one, that's the isotope effect for what isotope is this?
This is for cobalt.
For cobalt. So would you expect that then for palladium you would see something different in the isotope effect?
Well, that's a good question. We did measurements in the glassy state in a cobalt zirconium glass. I showed these very low isotope effects. This is all cobalt isotope effect. We did measurements on zirconium. Here we couldn't measure the isotope effect because zirconium is so slow. But we measured the pressure dependence, and we found an activation volume of the order of an atomic volume. And we wouldn't exclude that at least in these binary glassy systems, a large component carries out single atom jumps. This seems to be suggested by our results. There's also a report on inverse Kirkendall effect by King II and others. Kirkendall effect is probably not known to all of you because this is more from material science. If you have a vacancy type mechanism and you have components with different mobility, then the vacancies will accumulate on one side and will segregate, and you see these Kirkendall voids. And in such systems, if you have different concentrations, then you also see Kirkendall voids, but on the wrong side. Because if the small components diffuse by a collective mechanism without vacancies, and if the large component diffuses by a vacancy type mechanism, then the voids are on the wrong side compared to the crystalline system. So there is some indication that vacancies may play a role in those systems.
And would you also comment on the paper from the MD simulation from Herbert Schober about the activation volume, apparent activation volume under pressure, since you mentioned it,
yes.
Rainer? Which seems to peak at the mode coupling temperature?
Yeah, unfortunately, we did a lot of measurements on activation volumes, but in this regime, we are unfortunately not able to measure. But this seems to be a very important result. It would be nice if it could be experimentally verified, but I have no doubt that we would find this effect, but we are not able to do it in this regime.
Only the Palladium system.
Yeah,
systems.
Yeah.
So last question over here.
Thanks. Do you think there is a connection between your results and the dynamic heterogeneity? Do you mean that the slow particles, they are basically large atom rich, or zirconium rich, or palladium rich?
Yeah, I think from the experimental picture, it's clear that in our system for the large component, the Stokes-Einstein equation is obeyed over a huge temperature range. But I wouldn't go so far to say that for palladium, we have no dynamic heterogeneities. I think I leave this to the computer simulation people to show this. But one could naively interpret it in this way. Maybe you can comment on this.
Not now. Break is waiting. So let's thank Franz again.